History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to if we do our job, if we take some initiative, ask a few questions, and then invest some time to listen. We can make a bigger difference than maybe we understand. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When I started interviewing World War II vets 20 years ago, the urgency of how quickly we were losing them was a major motivation. Today, estimates are that roughly 60,000 World War II veterans remain out of 16 million who served. And today's episode is dedicated to remembering a special vet who just passed away at the age of 102. The New Mexico Veterans Home in Truth or Consequences, TRC as the locals call it, is where Bill DeGeneres finished a journey that took him throughout the Pacific during World War II, included a lot of time in Los Angeles, but began in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I asked Bill if he remembered anything about those early years.
No. I was 5 years, 6 years old. No, I don't remember much until I remember some of the trips. We took two or three trips to California. My dad was in business with his brother, and they had some disruption, something, and I heard that his brother pulled a gun on him. So that's when we left.
That sounds like a good reason to leave.
Yeah. So we came to California. In the old days, I remember some of the old roads, and we drove a Model T out here from Louisiana, and Dad carried extra boots for the tires, because the tires, I guess they had inner tubes, but he had to have a lot of repair stuff for that, and boots to put in the tires. So a lot of the roads were gravel roads in those days. So it would take us a week to get to California. It was a long drive, but we made it. And Dad was a very industrious person, and he always found work. In fact, he went to work for MGM Studios soon after he got out here, because he met some friends that worked for MGM, and they sicked him into that. And he became a set painter at MGM. He painted a big sign up on top of the lion, rode for Metro Golden Mayor. He painted that a couple of times too. But that's the kind of work that he did, and we did okay. Nothing great. We did okay, you know. After I got out of the Navy, I worked a couple of places, and then before I met my wife, I went to work for Hal Roach Studios. They're the ones that produced Amos and Andy and Laurel and Hardy. And My Little Margie was working when I worked there. That was another program. Because at the time when I went into Hal Roach Studios, I became a sign painter. We did what they call the credits for movies. We'd get the list of credits, and it was hand painting lettering on a white on a black background. That would be photographed and made into a display that moved over for the beginning credits and for the ending credits of a movie, you know. So we did that. And I didn't meet too many movie stars. Arthur Lake, met a few minor, I met Hedy Lamarr one time, yeah. Oh, that's about it, yeah. Yeah, I had to work a lot, so.
You went in the Navy before Pearl Harbor, about 9 months before Pearl Harbor. You hadn't finished high school yet. You're 17 years old. What was your motivation? Why did you make that decision?
Well, my dad had been in the Navy in World War I. We'll get to that later, because he was again in the Navy during World War II. And he was a chief pharmacist mate, and he did a lot of traveling in the Philippines and all in the Orient there and aboard ship. And it was very exciting to think about going out and seeing all things, other parts of the world, you know, and being aboard ship. And I kind of, in the back of my mind, always had thought I would like to do what my dad did. He didn't retire from the Navy, but he was born in 1898. 98, and he went in when he was about 17, I think, and he stayed until the end of the war. I always enjoyed him telling me about some of the stuff, and in fact, he got tattoos, and I thought, no, God, I never want tattoos. He had tattoos all over his chest and his arms, you know. He, a tiger and a lady up across his chest. I remember that, and I thought, no, I'll never do that. But I did, a couple of, when I went in the Navy. So that was my one reason I wanted to join, and I felt like I just needed something to happen. I wasn't happy in the 12th grade, and my brother graduated a semester, I guess, before I would have, and he joined the Army. That was in 1940, I guess. He joined the Army, and he got basic training into the Air Force right away. But I just made up my mind I wanted to go and join the Navy, and I told Mom and Dad that's what I wanted to do. And Dad was, of course, let the kids go, you know. And so, but I did. I enlisted, and I got my high school diploma within the first few months in the Navy. So they got it for the schooling that I went to in the Navy. My mother helped pick that up for me. So there I was in the Navy. What am I going to do now? So I wanted to go. They get, when you go get out of basic training in the Navy, they give you three options of different schoolings if you want to do when you get out of basic training, out of that. And I told them, I wanted to be an aviation machinist mate, an aviation machine mate, or a medical corpsman. So they sent me to the medical corps school. So that's what started. And it was okay because I liked it after I got into it. It was my same thing my dad did. And I stayed with that, of course, till the end of my service time.
Do you remember December 7th, 1941, and how you found out about that attack on Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yes, yes. I had been home on leave from the, on Liberty, so to speak, Saturday. And we, like we did every time I come to LA, when I went partying with friends and dancing and having a good time. And I was, Sunday morning was December the 7th, I was fast asleep, and some friend of mine came over banging on my door. Get up, and I, what do you want, you know? Don't bother me, I'm tired. But he told me the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and you got to get back to your base immediately. So I knew that, so I jumped on that, and I guess I had breakfast and everything, and I left. And what I usually did on the weekend to go back to San Diego, I stick my thumb out there on the 101 highway to San Diego, and there was hundreds of guys along the road there looking for roads or a ride. But I found a ride and got into the at the Naval Hospital at the time, and it was in an upheaval, and quickly they assembled us and assembled everybody out on the drill field. Uh-huh. And the captain gave us a big speech about, he was really excited, I could remember that. And some of the guys around me were really excited. A couple were crying, oh. And so the speech that the captain gave us was, we don't know what's happening now, so in so many words. There may be enemy out offshore, so we have to militarize the whole base. We were all given a rifle if we needed, and I was assigned to a barracks like other people. We stayed with people there, and I carried medical equipment for bandaging and stuff like that. So that was for 2 or 3 days till they quieted down, found out the Japanese weren't coming in yet, but they still had a problem out in Pearl. I stayed there until I was drafted back into the Marine Corps.
And that was at the hospital or the training center?
That was at the training center, yeah.
I'm really glad you shared that, because so often we talk about the things that happened. We don't realize what almost happened. And I've heard so many stories from people in Southern California at that time that there was a real palpable fear that the Japanese were coming to California.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, we didn't know. Nobody knew. I mean, There was no traffic between the States and Pearl except for wireless, I guess. So that was the only information they had. And of course, they didn't know in Pearl what the Japanese were going to do. They had just had to sit and wait and try to pick up what they got to protect the island, you know. And of course, all the National Guard and what army that was in the States patrolled all the coast, and immediately they turned out all the lights at nighttime, and anybody could be arrested for driving a car with the lights on, you know. So it was kind of exciting.
Yeah, and you said when they took you all out there on the parade grounds and lined you up and gave you that speech, you said some of your fellow sailors were excited, some of them were crying. What about you? How did you feel about this big news and this big change in the world and your world?
Like any other body, I was pretty nervous about it. You know, what's going to happen, you know? I just accepted the way things were, and I didn't get too excited about it, but, you know, I was nervous. What's going to happen now? And it was a feeling that happened right at the time when right after the Pearl Harbor, and everybody's all excited, you know. But we calmed down a while and went on routine when they found out no invasion was coming. So we just consolidated what we were doing right then and went back to work. That's all. Of course, I was a Marine, a Navy with the Marines, and I wore a Marine uniform with the arm insignia. I became a third class and then a second class, and later I got a first class petty officer while I was with the Marines. Being with the Marines, at first we went to from San Diego Naval Hospital or Naval the recruit depot, that is. We went into Camp Elliott, which was north of San Diego, which was a Marine base at the time in 1941 and 42. At that time, they had taken over 144,000 acres in Oceanside, and they developed Camp Pendleton there at Oceanside. So we didn't stay long at Camp Elliott. They told us they were opening up Camp Pendleton, and we had to get up there, and the way we were going to get up there was walk. So that's the Marines, you know. So we all loaded up. It was a whole 3rd Marine Division at the time was forming. And so we hiked. It took us, I think, 3 days to go up to Camp Pendleton and open the new barracks there and open everything and move in. And that was when we started training for overseas duty then. I went with the 3rd Special Weapons Battalion, Fleet Marine Force. And we had a 75-millimeter cannon mounted on a half track. We had two or three mounted 20-millimeter cannon on them. Were partially shielded, and we had lots of 30 caliber and 50 caliber and other things that we like training for hand grenade and that kind of. That was all at Camp Pendleton. That's what I did while I was there, and a lot of hiking.
Your first deployment, your first trip overseas, from San Diego to where?
New Zealand. We went into Auckland, New Zealand. We landed there, that was in 42, I guess. We went from New Zealand, got aboard ship in a bunch, and went to the Solomon Islands, and we landed on Guadalcanal, which was just had been secured just before we got there. So we didn't really have any bad things happen there, except about every other night we got what they call Sewing Machine Charlie. A plane would fly over our area and drop a couple of bombs. So we learned to dig foxholes there. And we were in a coconut grove there, and we also had to be careful of coconuts falling. But that was not a bad experience. We stayed there, and that's where I learned that my father was right across the bay from us in Tulagi, on the island of Tulagi, which was maybe the Solomon's Islands are a string of islands. I don't know, there must be a dozen or so islands. And this island was parallel to Guadalcanal, Tulagi, across the way. And my dad, we had been communicating by mail, and I found out his flotilla was over there. That was He was aboard a converted World War One destroyer. They called them the old four stackers.
Yeah.
And it was called APD 17 or 19, I forget now. And after communicating, I had found out he was there, so I got permission to fly over there, not fly over, take a island, inter-island traffic over there. And I've met him and stayed with him a couple of times, and we watched the movies on his boat while we were there. It was very pleasant, you know. And then we got, I don't know how long we were there on Guadalcanal, maybe, a few weeks or months or so. And we got orders that we were going to move up the slot, what they call it, to an island up there. And at the time, I didn't know who it was.
It's time for our first break. We are honoring Bill DeGeneres today after his passing at the age of 102. We're going to hear some of what he witnessed in the Pacific as a Navy corpsman with the Marines when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode in honor of World War II veteran Bill DeGeneres, who passed away August 26th at the age of 102. A Navy corpsman who enlisted before the attack on Pearl Harbor, Bill had the unique opportunity of meeting up with his father, who was also serving in the Pacific.
So he invited me to come see if I could get aboard his ship and go with him up there. You know, I didn't know it was going to be an invasion or we were just moving. So I asked my captain about that, you know, and he said, sure, if you want to go over there, go ahead with him, you know. Take a little boat and go. Everything was pretty loose in those days. So I went aboard his ship, and a day later, we all got together, and his ships got together, and there was LSTs and troop ships. I don't know, there was a few running parallel to go up the slot. We left in the evening, and it was, it doesn't take too long to go up through there. In the middle of the night or early morning, still dark, we got general quarters. Everybody had to go out on deck. We all go out on deck and keep sailing. And I was on his ship there, you know. And pretty soon we hear these planes flying, you know, all around. This plane went past our fantail and went across because there was two lines of ships going up. About that time, the LST across the way, maybe 100 yards or more, open fire all along. It looked like a blowtorch coming out. It hit that plane and knocked it down. Right, just, you know, not too far from it. Kaploop. It was pretty bad because there was another plane. It was a torpedo plane came by and dropped behind this guy when he was shot down. There was another one of them. They said they were float planes. I couldn't see them. I just saw dark things coming over, and the flames from the rear, from the motors. You know, this second plane, they was fired on, but he had already dropped his torpedo, and he didn't get knocked down, but it hit one of Dad's ships, same type of ship, a four-stacker, and I saw that thing just blow up, and it was pretty bad. Yeah, there was a few of them. I guess a lot of them on that ship were killed, and my dad said, "Yeah, it wasn't his ship; it was one of his ships that was knocked down." So they lost a lot of that personnel. So, and then after that, we went on up into Bougainville, and Dad got a shore boat to pick me up and take me to where I was to be bivouacked on Bougainville, down the southern part of Bougainville. Mm-hmm. That's it for that day.
I can see why you haven't forgotten that day. That sounds pretty memorable. And now this is going to be just a series of islands that you're spending the next couple years of your life on, and your job there is to take care of Marines if they're wounded, right?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you have to start doing that?
Well, not for a while yet. After Bougainville, we came back to Guadalcanal, and we weren't there for more than a few weeks. And they said, "We're getting aboard ship. We're going on maneuver." So the whole bunch of us, part of the division, got on two or three ships, had to climb the rope ladder to get them on that. What an experience that is. You know, you look down, that the water's a long way down below. So you learn to grab the vertical rope, and don't put your hands on the horizontal rope, because somebody's going to step on you, you know. But anyway, we went to a couple of islands out while we were out. They said it was Iniwetok or Kwajalein, and we went ashore, and they put some beer in a couple of shore boats, and we had a beer fest on the beach there, and it was hot. And there was a funny thing that happened. One of the guys found there's a certain kind of crab in those islands. It's got claws like you wouldn't believe, and it's a big, big crab. Anyway, he found a crab, and he stuck his rifle down there to poke the crab, and the crab grabbed the sights on his rifle and bent the sights. Oh, those claws were like 6 or 8 inches long. So it wasn't bad, but he grabbed him, just pushed him. So he got rid of that. But that was a nice experience. You know, he had a break in routine and stuff. We got to go out and swim that day and enjoy a little food and the beer that they sent with for us too. So we got back a warship after that, and I guess we visited another island. They were, from what I can remember, they were just planning maneuvers or planning what to do in case of an invasion. That's all I could see. All we did was get aboard and sit and wait for something to happen, you know. Back to Pinochle, you know. So anyway, then we went back to Guadalcanal, waited for something to happen. Then we loaded up after that. Wasn't more than 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. We loaded up and several ships, and we took off. Where we were going to go, we don't know. They wouldn't tell us, you know. They we just going. And there was several troop ships. I would say at least 4 or 5. And so it was quite a trip from, I don't know how long, from there to the Marianas. That's where we went from there. And then they told us that we were back up for the next invasion. It was in for Saipan and Tinian in the Marianas. So we all were out on deck when we went up, and they dropped anchor out there, and we saw the other ships, not ships, but the LCV, please, landing ship dock, taking the Marines inshore to the, we were fairly close. We were within 200 or 300 yards at least of the coast, and all the LSTs were, LCVPs were getting together in a big line of them that went ashore, and we could saw what was happening. Explosions, mortar fire, stuff like that. We were just sitting there, you know, are we going to go? And they said no. So we waited until dark, and they pulled up anchor, and then said, we're going somewhere else. And And I asked my captain, what are we going to do? He says, I don't know. He says, we have to get orders. So the next day, early, we were all, get your gear together, we're going ashore. So we're getting ready, and all the shore boats were circling to pick us up. And so they came one by one, pick us up, and down the rope ladder we go again and get in the boats. And we went ashore, and as we're going ashore, we saw a lot of cannon fire. So anyway, we went into the beach, and ahead of me, there was a line of LCPBs that went into the beach first, and they were fired upon. I thought, well, we're going to get in that. But by the time we got in there, a lot of it had already moved inland. They pushed them inland, and there was mountain work that they were heading to go up over and around. And about that time, there was a lot of aircraft coming in, and they were shooting missiles into the refetments or the defensive places that the Japs had. So I watched a lot of that, and there was no fire by the time I got there. It was already moved inland, so we all had to dig foxholes waiting for the next thing to happen, which not much of it happened. It all went inland. So what they did, they set up the aid station, and I worked in the aid station for two or three days, and then they put me in grave registrations because I had the dental experience, and they needed somebody to identify undefiable personnel, which I worked at for a week or so until they used me for other things after that.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who had that kind of duty. Some of them only dealt with a few casualties, and some of them thousands. But how hard was that to carry out that duty, knowing this is a guy that could have been you?
Well, not fun at all. And the part about it was, that was about a week after we landed. They put me on grave registration, where they were digging the grave sites and collecting body bags for them. And they were setting that all up, and I had half a dozen or a dozen unidentifiable bodies, and I had to chart their teeth, which would be to the best of my ability. The bodies were in not good shape most of the time, and it was kind of gruesome and smelly, of course. You know, it's not fun. And so that's what I did. And I found out one of my buddies had been killed ahead of me. His name, Herb Clark, was a good friend of mine. And I didn't see his body or anything, but I found out it was him, and he'd already been buried. And he was buried before the graveyard was established, and they had to go out and dig him up and bring him up, and they knew who he was, and so I didn't have to identify him. In fact, I wrote a letter to his wife. I got a permission to do that, and I sent a letter of condolences, best as I could do, to help his wife understand that he did have friends out there. Later on, after the war, she contacted me, and I went out and met his wife and his mother and father. I understand later they had his body reinterred from Guam and brought to the States, and he was reinterred in and around the Veterans Cemetery there in Westwood.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll ask you more about Herb Clark, because that really underscores all of this. So this is Guam, where you came ashore, and you're seeing what can happen, and then you lose one of your friends. You said a real good friend, Herb Clark. Is there something that you process yourself when that happens? That, do you think any more about the possibility that you could be next?
Oh, I always thought that.
But he made it home, and he lived to 102. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, Bill DeGeneres' honor flight experience and some of his artistic contributions after his time in the Navy, which, by the way, also included the Korean War era. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode honoring the late Bill DeGeneres, a World War II Navy veteran who passed away at the age of 102. As a Navy corpsman with the Marines, Bill's duty was a dangerous one.
They'd always stick the corpsman right at the back end of the line of the patrol. And I always had to watch over my shoulder because that's what the Japs would do. They would be in these round holes. They'd just stand there and wait for the troops to go by and pop up and shoot them, you know. And that's what I was always afraid of. But it didn't happen. It did happen several times that I've heard of but not know of.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories out there. And my grandfather was in the medical corps in Europe, got a Silver Star, and he had the Red Cross on his helmet. And there were different times where he was told, well, they're actually shooting at you if they had that Red Cross, even though they weren't supposed to. And I've heard stories of some of the Marine Corps battles, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, where corpsmen were specifically targeted because the Japanese knew that would increase the casualties.
I don't know. Later on in the campaign in the Pacific, after Guadalcanal, they learned real quick at Guadalcanal, don't put a Red Cross on your shoulder because you were a target right then. And so the corpsmen never put it on. In fact, we didn't carry it. Any time I went out, patrol duty or anything, no Red Cross. And so that was the extent of anything happening to me. I was never in danger as far as I can remember because I wasn't shot at.
Other than the time, you know, Washing Machine Charlie came by and dropped bombs, or the cannon fire when you're coming into Guam, or the sniper when you're... I mean, you say you weren't shot at, but most of us haven't experienced those things you just told us.
No, there's only one time I remember that there was a lot of shooting, but I was staying pretty low at the time, and that was when I was on Bougainville. And we were close to the beach, and there was snipers that come through once in a while. And we were always on guard at nighttime, because that's when the Japs would try to locate us and fire on us. And that's all I remember, seeing tracers, you know, nothing really happened. In fact, there's one time we were sent over to another beach, our whole company. They told us to dig in along the beach. They were expecting boatloads of Japanese to come in for an invasion. So we spent all night long watching the water, and nothing ever happened. But that was kind of an exciting place. I didn't sleep much.
Well, you answered my question there about whether you were able to sleep. And so you were still out there in the Pacific when Japan eventually surrendered?
In fact, that was after I came home from the Pacific from the Marines. Okay. On Guam, I got my orders. It was 26 months I'd been out there then. And so I got my orders to go back to the States. I did my tour of duty in the Pacific. I'm darn lucky I got it then because my company were starting to pack up. They had orders for the next invasion. And they packed up, and I found out later, it was all 3rd Marine Division and a couple other Marine Divisions that went into Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. So they had a pretty rough time from then on. And I missed that, but from there I went back to Pearl, and then I caught another ship and went back into Mare Island. And I got orders to meet with another company at the San Diego, Coronado Island. We had I forget the name of the ships were down there, but they were all Marine ships. Like it was an LST I was assigned to. I was the only medical personnel on that ship. But after that was after I landed in Mare Island, and they gave me orders to appear to the fleet down in San Diego. And the amphibious fleet is down below. But that was after I had given 2 weeks leave after we landed in Mare Island, sent me on a train down to my home to L.A., and I spent 2 weeks spending a lot of money that I wanted to do something after I've been in the islands all that time. Yeah. But anyway, that was I stayed with Mom and Dad was still overseas then. Then I had to go down to the amphibious training base. That was it. Okay. And caught this LSM. They needed a corpsman because the corpsman had something happened. He had tour duty, and he had left. So they needed a corpsman right away because they were leaving the next morning. So that night I had to take my sea bag and everything. That was right after I had my vacation. That night I loaded aboard the LST. The skipper, which was a JG lieutenant, he had another lieutenant with him, which was a navigator. They introduced me to the crew, which was a crew of 10 or 12 men, something like that. And we loaded aboard. They gave me a stateroom. An LSM is like an LST. It's a tanker where they have a deck all the way back. They have the big doors that open to the ocean at the bow. And on both sides is where they have the compartments for personnel on either side. And I had my room was right next to my first aid station. And that's where I set up my clinic right there. But they introduced me that night, and we went in, packed up and unpacked, and got ready. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we shoved off. That was really quick. So we went from there. I never was exactly sure what that ship was used for, but it was mainly we took a lot of supplies out to. We stopped in Pearl, and we stayed there for 2 or 3 days. And loaded up some more supplies. And from there, we went out to Marcus Island. I don't know if you ever heard of Marcus Island, which was close to Japan. And we unloaded supplies out there. And I met a world-famous World War boxer, Jim Braddock. I met Jim Braddock out there. He had a crew of Americans, and they were doing loading, that was an unloading crew, that's what they were. And some guy said, "That's Jim Braddock out there." I said, "What? Okay, I knew of him." So I got his autograph, went over and got his autograph. But that was the extent of what we actually did. After that, we was heading back, I guess, back to Pearl. We got news that the Japanese had surrendered. We were out in the middle of the Pacific, and I think we went down to Eniwetok. I think it was Eniwetok. We went in there, went into the bay in there, and that night, you never saw so many fireworks in your life. They told us, be careful, there's going to be stuff dropping around, you know. But nothing happened, so. From there, we went to Pearl, and that's what was, and I was, went ashore. I was discharged from that boat, that ship. The LSNs were pretty nice. They were a nice ship, but they were, I don't know if you know, an LST is about two-thirds longer than that, just a bigger ship in contrast. But I got off from there at Pearl, and I spent a few days from there, and I caught another ship, and we went to San Diego, and I got discharged there. I'm here because of two bombs. I don't thank the bombs. I mean, you know, that's a terrible thing. It's only one thing that it did, and that stopped the war.
Well, we wouldn't have this conversation otherwise, and we also wouldn't have some amazing artwork that you've produced in over all these decades since then. And I know you worked a few jobs, you went to college, you met your wife, but technical illustration, a lot of people wouldn't even know what that means. It kind of became your life's work. What are some of the pieces or drawings that you came up with, paintings, that give you the most pride?
Well, technical illustration, like I learned it, is taking engineering blueprints and converting them into two-dimensional or three-dimensional illustrations from the blueprint so that it could be printed and labeled for use as parts illustration for catalogs for mechanics or other people or engineers want to see what the product looks like and how to take it out of that, like part of an engine or part of an air conditioning system or any systems in an aircraft that comes apart had to be labeled and put into a catalog. And that's what we did. I learned to do that. Right down to the nuts and bolts, label the nuts and bolts, any part. And they wanted, if it had to be serviced, we had to have an illustration of. At Brown, it was Bob Brown Illustration Company that I worked for. That's where I got my training. And I stayed there for over a year. And I got more money after a while from that. And that's when I went into more illustration and color and painting illustration with this engineer. Because when I first went to System Development Corporation, they needed drawings of the coastline of California, of different installations. Well, they had Nike Hercules installations all up and down the coast at the time. So they needed pictures of the illustration of where there was anti-aircraft deal, because System Development Corporation was a company that was making illustrated and movable, like a Mickey Mouse cartoon. They made moving illustrations of incoming aircraft and bombing by foreigners that they thought would be the Russians at the time. So we did a lot of illustration of big catalogs of complete invasions of the United States of all over for NASA.
That's a story all on its own. That's a surreal thought to have to put onto paper the way you did. And I'm going to put up some photos, if it's okay, at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see some of your artistic talent. What's the story behind this painting that's still at the Smithsonian?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to show it to you. It's of the first space shuttle. Uh-huh. Space shuttle taking off into space. I was working with this scientist, Bob Salkill. Robert Salkill. He was developing new types of exotic propulsion systems for spacecraft. And the first one would go on the space shuttle, which was developed with the propulsion system on the aircraft for taking off and going into space. And that was later, they dropped that and just used that for coming back to Earth, for retroing back into Earth. So the painting that he wanted to see was of the space shuttle taking off, shooting out the flames at the back, heading off into space from the Earth. And that's what I did in color. It's all three-dimensional.
How long did that take you?
Oh, between a couple of drawings, two or three drawings, preliminaries, several. And he lived in Sacramento at the time, so I would get a rental car and drive up to see him, and with new illustrations, and in between times, he was going back and forth to other places. I don't know what he would do. I'd take him these illustrations from the blueprints and from the preliminary drawings that he had made with other engineers. So from that, I developed what they wanted to see. And this is a space shuttle of the space shuttle taking off, heading towards us out to outer space.
You didn't get to see that at the Smithsonian when you went on the honor flight, did you?
No, I did not get to see it. It was somewhere at the Smithsonian, somewhere.
Didn't have time to dig through all their collection. But speaking of the honor flight, I mean, this is so many years after the war that you end up going to Washington, D.C., 70 years after you were there with the Marines throughout the Pacific. What was that experience like for you? What were the parts of that that stood out for you?
It was so quick and fast. Everything was great to see. I mean, to go see the Smithsonian and see the different things that they had, several different aircraft. In fact, they had one of the spacecraft that they shot off around the Earth from first modules, what they call, that type of thing. It was so great to see it. And they had models of ships and things like that. It was It was just great to see. It was so quick to go. I wanted to spend a week there, but we just couldn't do it, you know.
Well, I do want to ask you specifically about a couple other things you saw there. The Marine Corps Memorial, and that's where that quote that I mentioned earlier is etched. Admiral Nimitz, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. And I'm thinking, you saw that firsthand, and you cared for some of these wounded Marines who had things you'd never seen before. You talked about identifying bodies by their teeth, that they were in that kind of condition. When you saw that Marine Corps memorial with that quote on it and thinking about everything it represents, what was that moment like for you?
You're talking about the memorial for Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. It broke me up. Just brought back, pardon me.
That's a powerful place.
That was a highlight of my trip there, to see that. That's really something. I still don't know his name. Somebody told me that one of the corpsmen on there was in my graduating class from the Corps School. I'd like to double check that. I've got a list somewhere in my old stuff of my Corps School graduating class. I've got a list of all of the people in that. I'd like to double check that. Get the name of the corpsman on there. It's not a great deal, but it's something that I would think. I knew that guy. He was in my company, you know, because that's quite a thing to see.
And we know that the emotions are real and that the lives were real, and 406,000 American lives were the cost of World War II, not to mention so many wounded physically and otherwise. You mentioned a friend who came back all broken up. I know it wasn't easy for your brother as a fighter pilot in Europe. When you went to that World War II memorial, here a war that you and your brother and your father all served in, and there's that wall of gold stars there representing those 406,000 Americans. Were there some thoughts that went through your mind or reflections while you were looking at that?
Oh, you think about the things that you saw and happened on all the way from New Zealand through the Solomons, all the way into the Marianas and some of the atolls, and a ship being blown up. And I saw a few aircraft shot down, things like that. Those things go through your mind, and you know, you're so glad nothing happened to you, but you're so sad about the other Marines and the friends that you lost. You know, they'll always be gone. I still have a lot of tender thoughts about Marines. The Marines I knew, they were a bunch of good guys.
Well, and you shared the name of one of them who was killed on Guam, not too far away from where you were, Herb Clark. Have you ever thought, well, maybe let me ask you this. Can you tell us what kind of guy he was? Like, what he was like?
He was a big guy. He was about, 6'2". And a very happy person, very intelligent guy. And he was married before he went out overseas. He had a beautiful wife. Of course, I met her later. And we played pinochle together. We talked a lot of times. And it was just a type of a good friendship. He was went back up to Auckland from Pukekohe. And he was in the same load, went up there. And everybody disappeared when they got into Auckland, and he'd tell me about some of the nice times he had, met some nice girls. It was kind of fun, you know. He wasn't a philanderer or anything like that. Very personable guy. I really liked him, and he used to tell me about his home life and what he was going to do after the war. He wanted to go back to college. I don't know what he was going to do. And he'd tell me about his wife and family there. His family was well-to-do, and his wife family well-to-do. And, of course, I saw their place in Beverly Hills when I was there. And the people were there. They were all super nice people, really, really good. And I'll always remember him for being just a nice guy.
Well, one thing I don't want to forget to say is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that helps us understand the price that's been paid for our freedom. Is there something that you look back on and you'd say that's what I'm most proud of, or that's what I'm most thankful for?
Well, I'm proud to have served my country. Number one, I did what I can. Nothing memorial happened to me other than I served my time, and it was with honor.
And we honor him today. Bill DeGeneres finished his journey on Earth after 102 years, leaving behind a powerful legacy and the memories we heard today, memories that give us perspective and remind us again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.